This episode of AVXL is brought to you by our awesome crew of Patreon supporters. Check out our page at patreon.com/AVXL. AVXL episode 32 recorded on December 21st, 2016. We're going to talk Blu-rays to show off your home theater, LG's new laser projector, review Panasonic's DMP UB700 4K Blu-ray player, get you some cheap HDMI cables that do all the things, at least until HDMI 2.0 comes out in a couple weeks. All that and so much more on this episode of AVXL.
Testing 1, 2, 3. All right. I'm not blowing anything out.
Ignorant weasels chewing on your soul. Ignorant weasels. Do you have speed?
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide.
Yeah.
Welcome to AVXL, your guide to the best in home theater gear and content, no matter what your budget is. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Herron.
And Mr. Herron would like to call out a very, very happy 70th birthday to Steven Spielberg.
Mr. Spielberg.
Which made me realize that we are much older than we used to be.
Sincere happy birthday.
Oh, my goodness.
To somebody who's created an awful lot of compelling content in my lifetime.
Yeah.
I can't even fully grasp all of the hours I have spent watching content directed by that individual.
Oh, my goodness. Or the interrelationship between sort of from an evolution of cinema, you know, the relationships between sort of him and Martin Scorsese and George Lucas and... Oh, my goodness. I can see the man's building in San Francisco, but I can't think of his name.
What building?
What building?
Yoda?
That's the problem is... No.
Not Lucas. Who are you talking about? Spielberg?
No.
Filmmaking?
No. Well, filmmaker, yeah.
He has a building
Zoetrope
here?
Studios.
Oh,
Apocalypse
oh.
Now.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, it's not coming to you either.
But no, I've read that book, and I'm trying to now picture the other guy with the winery.
Yeah.
George's friend.
Yeah.
Oh, that's killing me now. Never mind.
You know, it's amazing.
Had a winery.
Oh, man.
May still
Francis Ford Coppola.
Yes, thank you. Jeebus.
Goodness.
Terrible.
You know, so many of that movies have brought so much joy. But we were talking about Spielberg before I went on one of my inevitable side trips. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, Indiana Jones.
A lot.
You start looking at the man's output, and then what he's done as a producer.
TV, everything. You know, a life well lived. And,
yes.
And I'm grateful to be able to experience some of that goodness.
Yeah.
In my home theater environment.
Oh, my goodness. I'm looking at this list, man.
He's a reason I want home theater. He's putting out the content.
Well, I'm laughing because I'm scrolling down here, and I'm like, you know... 3-4 inches of this guy's IMDb page would be a career for most people.
Ugh. So good.
Yeah. Absolutely. Man, I want to watch so many good things.
Adding to the queue. Well, I ended up downtown yesterday in San Francisco to visit my eye doctor, or I should say my ophthalmologist, who gave me my yearly exam and everything. Was awesome, I must say.
This is good.
Slight prescription tweak, so I have now even, I've optimized my prescription better for my eyeball. So,
well, you also had an issue several years ago where you detached your retina.
I had an injury as a child, and that came back to haunt me like 30 years later, and that was about 8 years ago, and it detached again.
Yeah.
And now they have a new procedure, and it actually should be permanent now. Shouldn't be flying apart on me.
Remember that great conversation where you're like, I've just spent 4 days with a bubble of gas laying face down.
A week
the
plus.
Bubble of gas, like,
and my
holding
mother,
the retina.
My mother went through this recently, too. I spent a couple months ago when I had to take off for a couple weeks. That was one of the things I was dealing with. Mom had torn her retina after, I believe, banging her head. Little things like that. Anyway. it can cause a slight tear, so... My ophthalmologist, actually, she was the person who first, the last time I had an issue, I had a discoloration in my vision. It's like, what's that blob? Went and saw her. Within 24 hours, I think I was under the table or at the doctor's in the hospital getting the outpatient procedure done for that. Anyway, I just want to say everyone should get their eyes and ears examined on a regular basis. They have a couple of cool machines at my ophthalmologist's office. One was a eye-brain connectivity tester. Made by the good folks over at Zeiss.
Nice.
I've used that one before, and it's kind of neat. It just checks each eye independently. For what? Basically, to make sure that the wiring between your optic nerve and your brain is firing on all cylinders, or there are no issues there. So
to make sure the air is not. So I used to think of like, you know, air between chair and keyboard, and you're talking about error between back of eyeball and center of skull.
This is true, and it is exactly that. And then the new machine I had a chance to be subjected to was a cool 3D topographical eye scanner made by a company called Topcom. Apparently, there are a few companies that make these products, but this happened to be the one they had there. And apparently, when you place yourself in front of this device, from what I gathered, I'll look up some more specs on it. I'm checking out the webpage for this device, and it's pretty dense, I would say, in terms of what it is it's doing. But it's cool. It's before they were literally taking just regular snapshots of the back of my eye, looking at the retina and recording that. With this new machine, they're actually able to create not only that color imagery, but in essence, anywhere or any slice of that image now can be analyzed as far as its topographical information goes. In turn, contouring, shape changes, or surface problems that may exist in the back of the eye. Effectively, the way it looked like on the sensor, it looked like about 6 IR lights shining into my eye with the main lens objective right in front of that, probably recording in very fine detail.
Mm-hmm.
I want to figure out, and I want to look this up to see what kind of a resolution they're able to capture, because if they're recording minute variations on the back of a retina or on the retina of the eye, that's got to be fairly detailed in terms of well below sub-millimeter accuracy, I'm assuming.
One would think.
So that was pretty cool, and it was a brand new machine. Literally, they had just installed it this week, and they said they would be sending me a data file with all the cool information. And because both of my eyes were a little different, that machine actually did pick up on the exact differences of my eye in terms of vision across my field of view. One eye I have is effectively perfect, and the other eye, there is actually a spot within that vision where I can see better than the rest of it. And this machine actually detected all of that. It basically laid out a zone map of my vision in this one eye.
That's
pretty crazy. Yeah, and it actually highlighted something I was physically aware of but hadn't actually seen proof of. So anyway, I found also the good folks over at Zeiss have a cool online eye exam that's pretty basic. But anything to encourage anyone to just get a regular exam.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes your ears, too, because, hey, keep those senses active and firing as good as possible and you will have a long, enjoyable home theater.
I started taking
experience.
It's funny. Like, I started wearing reading glasses about 2 years ago. So I've never, I've been like 15-20 vision, and my distance vision is still fantastic.
Corrected. I have excellent vision.
Yeah. So, but it's been a hoot because like I only needed like 0.75 on the reading glasses, and I got to get them.
I have astigmatism, so basically I have to take my glasses off for things up close, or I'll start wearing bifocals, which I'm avoiding like the plague. I'd rather get the look of where I have to slide my glasses down and look over them at
people.
I've
been enjoying that.
That's a whole new move I'm perfecting right now. So
I've been using that on the boys. I'll be using the computer at home, and I'll slide the glasses down. My oldest hates that.
I just wanted to bring that up because, we talk about sound and vision enjoying that in an environment you put together, and it's important to make sure that you're taking care of that stuff.
Right.
So,
no, absolutely,
just to be aware of it.
Well, the other thing is, especially with hearing,
when things change.
Your
speak
hearing
up.
Is going to degrade over time. It's just a physical fact, and it's. I've also in some cases run into people who thought their hearing was damaged and it wasn't. They just assumed it, and in other cases, it's nice to know what's there and what isn't. Which reminds me, you were playing around with something on your Samsung phone.
Yeah, that was a neat function. I mean, it's been there forever, and I actually pinged Samsung for some more information. But if you dive into your sound settings, when you have either Bluetooth headphones or earbuds connected to your phone, it doesn't work with just the speaker built in. But let me unlock this real quick. But under those sound settings, I found a really kind of a nifty thing. And as I squeeze on over to Sounds and Vibration, sound quality and effects, and it's something called Adapt Sound. And what this did was basically with your earbuds on and sitting in a very quiet environment, it will guide you through a series of test tones in each ear and basically repeating the tones from low frequencies to high frequencies. And it creates a map in essence of the performance on each ear, and then creates effectively an equalization that then applies to all the audio you listen to, including phone calls too. So it personalizes that equalization to your ears, your specific type of hearing. And going through this setup with the DAP sound, and I believe this is, I forget when they added this feature. I know it was on the 6 phones, the Galaxy 6 phones, definitely on the 7s. It might have been even a little bit older, but right. I was looking at specifically on my Galaxy 7. I found that both my left and right ear, at least according to this test and the particular earbuds I was trying, was slightly different in certain frequencies, in certain low frequencies, actually. I was surprised. There were certain, it played the tone I heard on the left side, and when it played supposedly the same tone, I did not hear it on the right side. And it then bumped up that equalization a little bit, replayed it until it sounded about right. And then after that was done, I honestly, I would say overall, the audio quality was louder. So it's hard for me to determine if that's necessarily better. But I am leaving it enabled, and I like the way it sounds. Mm-hmm. And I am now curious, though, if that's something that anyone else is involved with as far as headphone manufacturers, a way to, you can go through an equalization for right. how it should sound, but when you get into that personal space.
Well, here's the, I mean,
should there be electronics to actually say, oh, we can compensate for slightly different characteristics in your own hearing?
There's a,
and I, or do you even want to do that? Is that somehow tainting the experience of the artist and the intent in delivering that to you? But I go back and forth on this because it's like, well, in one sense, yeah, you are changing it. But if you're changing it in such a way that it helps you perceive the content in a more accurate way,
well,
I think that could be interesting.
So there's a lot of stuff going on right now.
And I did ping Samsung about this feature, and I'm seeing if I can get like a white paper or some of that, some of the, if right. there's science behind this and what it is and what it is. So
there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. Let's kind of unpack what you're saying, right? Because there's the truth of audio, right? And which would be a live, being in the room during a live performance.
That would be my definition.
And then there's sort of an attempt to replicate the truth of audio, which is maybe doing a binaural recording, right, where you stuff a microphone in the left and right ear of a head and record that. And that gives you, you know, it's sort of this attempt to maximize true stereo magic, right? Because stereo is enough to create, you know, a full 3D spatial image where it's like, oh, the saxophone's there, and the guitar's there, and the vocals are there, and, you know. But the reality is the vast majority of music is crafted in a studio, right? And through a lot of magnificent engineering and tricks and hacks, and, you know, it goes through the initial recording, and then it goes, you know, then it gets mixed, and then it gets mastered. And all of that comes into crazy layers of what people do to make a particular pop song or to make a particular effect in a, you know, for a bunch of shoegazers or whatever kind of music you're into. And there's, you know, Black Flag's Depression, one of my favorite albums of all time. Nobody's going to call that, no disrespect to Spot, nobody's going to call that a sonic masterpiece in terms of studio recording, but, you know, it's always gotten the job done. And then you go on the other sort of end of the, you know, spectrum, like there's a reason you hear way too many Diana Krall songs, no disrespect to Ms. Krall, you know, at audio conventions, because it's kind of like, you know, this magnificent recording, this
totally.
Magnificent voice and this magnificent recording.
Ear candy.
Yeah, well.
But on the playback side of it, though.
And that's where I was, you know, getting to is, so speakers are tuned, you know, your hearing isn't flat, right? So there's the kind of the idea of the near field response, and there's everything kind of between your eardrums and the physical movements of the air that we perceive as sound. And that's where stuff gets complicated, because your ear canals are different from my ear canals, are different from your ears, are different from everybody else's ears. And this, you know, sort of the size, location, and
abuse.
Yeah, the abuse, right? And I'm not even thinking about the stuff inside the ears, but everybody's hearing is a little bit different. You know, Brent Butterworth did some really, really good writing on this, where he talked about, in one case, and I think we've talked about this, where there was this, what he thought was a particularly shrill headphone that had too much treble, but one of his, you know, cohorts listened to it and was like, oh, this is what I've been waiting for my whole life. And he's looking at him like, WTF? I'm interpolating Brent's reaction there. And the guy ended up going to an audiologist, and it turned out he had somebody had pulled the EQ down on the whole higher end range, the treble range of hearing. So he had a very, very reduced treble range. Harman Studios is doing some early industry. Let me try to do this with some consonants and distinct syllables.
It's all good.
Sean Olive and the crew at Harman are doing some interesting studies where they're figuring out, you know, they've been doing a series of studies. And one of the things they started looking at was, you know, what people like. One of the interesting things are what they think sounds natural and what people like. And those are not necessarily the same things. You know, one of the things that came out of the influence of listeners' experience, age, and culture on headphone sound quality preferences, where they had a whole bunch of people listen and kind of went through a process to have them grade it. And it include, quote, and I'm quoting an Audiophile Review article, Do We All Really Hear Things Differently, from Brent Butterworth. The subjects included trained and untrained listeners in Canada, China, Germany, United States, listeners ranging in age from under 25 to over 55 years old. They used Sennheiser HD800s, Odyssey LCD2s, Beats by Dre Studio, and then a headphone EQ'd with the Harman target curve the team developed through its research, because they're trying to find the ideal listening curve. And a lot of headphones, headphones are so much better than they used to be, like orders of magnitude better. And headphones are still a nightmare to design. Most people like a little more bass and a little less treble. And most audiophile headphones tend to have a little more treble.
I would say, though, that this particular feature for the adapt sound function on my phone, though, one thing it did encourage me, though, to do is actually go get a hearing test.
Yeah.
Because it was odd that it was if my equipment was working properly, there were differences in left and right ear hearing. And if I could have a audio delivery device, the headphones, actually compensate for that for me and help deliver a more, something that is not easier for me to perceive, but gives me a better representation of what it should sound like. Because if there's parts of my hearing missing, and it can be compensated for well, without distortion or unwanted artifacting or things like that.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that. Because I run into this on the display side of things, where I get clients who might be colorblind or color deficient in some part of their vision. And how cool would it be if I could somehow analyze how they see it, how they perceive, and then be able to adjust it and compensate specifically for their vision to help, you know, images that may not look right to the rest of us could actually improve and make it look better. So
I think it's interesting. I mean, it's amazing to realize I was talking with Laura Dragan at the Wirecutter, or emailing, because you did this amazing article on the best kids' headphones, right? And these kids' headphones are designed to minimize the potential for hearing loss, because something like one in every four, under 18, like one in every four kids has permanent hearing loss from basically jamming their earbuds in and turning them up too loud.
Yep.
Or
just 6-hour speed metal concerts.
Yeah.
That'll do it too.
That'll do it too. And one of the things that really freaked her out was she had never really investigated hearing loss and how easy it is to do permanent damage, and how relatively, if you have a relatively, you know, what would seem like a relatively low level of audio for an extended period of time, it'll start smashing the cilia flat inside your eardrum.
Not good.
But they picked a fantastic headphone. I think you've heard them, because we had a pair over here, Puro's BT2200. In part because, they're comfortable, they're stylish, but they're one of the only, they sound great. They're one of the only headphones that actually delivers the limitation on decibel levels, because a lot of the headphones targeted at kids that claim they limit the levels are either easily bypassed or do a crappy job at it.
Those companies should be shamed.
Because,
it's hard enough, I imagine, being a parent. You bought something that looks like it's going to help prevent this very kind of thing, yet in actual testing...
Journal of the American Medical Association, 2010, hearing loss in the U.S. adolescents aged 20 to 19 increased from 15% in 88 to 94 to 19.5% in 2005-2006. And it's also, noise, hearing loss from noise exposure, is anything like over 85 decibels. And the louder it gets, it can go to a matter of minutes or seconds.
Oh yeah.
You know, so the
oh yes.
You know, most, you know, your ears just aren't designed to handle that, right? And you know, I can totally see why one of your ears would be different than the other. I think about the number of hours, you know, as a 13-year-old operating a chainsaw to cut wood for our wood stove, I spent dozens or hundreds of hours operating a chainsaw.
Specific sporting activities that I've done that incorporate very loud sounds, mm-hmm. took more on one side than the other.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And I'm now thinking, yes.
You know,
yes.
I never wore ear protection operating a chainsaw.
Oh, I put earplugs in at the drop of a dime now.
You know, if you're young, protect your hearing now because it won't be there later on. I mean, the fact that I can still hear 15,000-16,000 hertz at the age of 46 is, I think, a minor miracle. Given a number of hours I spent at 100 dB in small concrete rooms with very, very loud bands. But, you know, noise-induced hearing loss is serious. You know, if you're doing loud things, even if you're just using a hammer, put earplugs in or put ear protection on. You know, it's $8 at Home Depot or Amazon. Buy a cheap set of earmuffs and use them when you're using a hammer or something.
Use them all the time. Love it. Earplugs and earmuffs,
yes,
for those extremely loud environments that I deal with.
So. You know, when I looked at Odyssey's signs, they're sealed over-ear, more on-ear, not over-ear. One of the things that's interesting with the Cypher lightning cable for those is it comes with a customizable customizable EQ application.
Oh, nice.
And the information is stored in the cable itself rather than on the phone. So anytime you plug it into a phone with that application, it'll automatically go to your settings. So I can completely see that in the future there will be a series of applications that do EQ based on a DSP built into the cable or the phone that will be able to compensate for your hearing.
But
your hearing loss.
I mean, I've always had an EQ setting on just about every mobile device I've had, but it was that ability for it to go through a series of tones on each side and then actually can you hear this? No,
well, that's,
yes.
I mean, that's...
Here, we'll bump it up a little bit. Can you hear that? Yes, no. If you do go and actually use that feature within the Samsung phones, you have to be in a very, very quiet environment and make sure you're going to use it with the headphones you usually use it with or mm-hmm. earbuds or whatever. But just make... They're exceedingly quiet tones, at least in my opinion, they are. So
they are.
Make
well, that's
sure
the
you're,
point,
yeah. Right?
Anybody can hear it if it's loud.
There's no volume adjustment on this test. It was just you plug it in, you sit there quietly, and I actually found it a challenge to find somewhere quiet enough to do this test. That was the first funny part.
I read a great article recently where somebody pointed out the number one thing most people can do for their listening room is to just make the environment quieter.
Block external sound.
Oh my goodness! Yeah, no, it's funny because as an audiophile or audio geek is probably closer to the truth. You know, when I started getting really, really into serious audio, passive preamplifiers and basically eliminating things from the signal path. Like I haven't had a home stereo with a treble or bass knob in 20 years. You know, I'm running a digital output directly into a power amplifier to the speakers.
Yep.
So like, there's part of me that's like just thinks that, you know, digital signal processing is anathema. And then there's also part of me that's thinking about the weirdness of the room where the speakers I set up. And I got to see a demo from of Elac's doing a really cool, the EA-101 EQ-G, which is an integrated amplifier. And it's pretty... you know, it blends the subwoofer with your main speakers, and it does has a built-in DSP to do room correction, and that's a really fascinating idea to me. It's also really, really small. It's really interesting, sort of Class D amplifier, where they did some funny stuff to make it perform more like sort of a Class AB amplifier. But I'm kind of really curious to play around with the DSP in the living room and see what that does to the audio and how it sounds. Because I think I like that a lot more than hanging stuff off the ceiling and the walls to tune the room.
Although, generally, you don't have to put a lot of stuff for treating a room.
True.
I mean, you can go as nuts as you want, but it usually isn't required to cover every square inch of every surface to, you know.
The problem is I need to put like a 4-foot by 2-foot panel basically in front of one of the windows and in front of one of the bookshelves, and that's going to be really, really awkward.
Speaking of rebuilding a nightmare... Are you still working on your AV closet?
Oh my goodness, I am. In part because I've been testing all those the mesh wiring networking, and I'm pulling everything apart, and like I'm extending the shelf 4 inches forward, and I'm building a second shelf, and things are getting hung on the wall because I realize you need the power on the back wall, and the cables that are coming through the wall and up from the floor. Yeah, it's a nightmare. But I wanted to mention some of my favorite things. Number one, being Velcro. There's probably a Velcro section in your local hardware store, and if not, there certainly is in your local Home Depot or Lowe's. Velcro's 8-inch by 1/2-inch reusable ties. You get a 50-pack for $5.27.
Totally. There's also that gardening green Velcro-ish like tape.
Yeah.
And you can get that by the roll. I use that crap all the time. I mean, gardening too, but it's just like Velcro tape.
You've never seen Happy until you've seen Robert Herring.
Just wrapping
gardening.
Up cables with that stuff too. It's like gardening or cable management. Either way.
Yeah, the other thing is mounted head cable ties, which is a zip tie, and at the head end of the zip tie, there's basically a little thing to drive a screw through.
Yes.
If you've never seen them, cable tie mounting bases, which are a 1-inch by 1-inch square where you can run a cable. You basically, either they have a sticky tape on the back of the square, or you drive a screw through the square, and then you can run a zip tie through it if you're doing a bundle of cables. And a cool thing on the cableorganizer.com, which is...
That's a great website.
It is a fantastic website.
They've been around for a long time, too.
They've been around forever. But if you've never seen it, the universal cable tie is interesting because it's kind of a fat, wide zip tie that'll fit up to like 4.5-inch cable bundles, which are probably a little bigger than you have at home. But screw holes run through the zip tie, so you can basically do a zip tie and screw it to the wall immediately.
Nice.
Yeah, cableorganizer.com. If you've never been there, it's a fantastic website for figuring out how to hide cables and all sorts of stuff like that.
Very good.
Good stuff. You got a chance to get eyeballs and testing gear on Panasonic's DMP UB700 4K Blu-ray player review. And before you email, I assure you, we are looking to get our grubby little paws on Oppo's gear as quickly as possible.
I have an update on that, actually.
You do?
It's related to this. And I didn't actually test this. Panasonic's Blu-ray players are actually in the UK currently. And I'm not sure if you can... I think you can get the 900 here in the U.S., but they have their new... the premium models, the DMP UB900. There's the DMP UB700. And the folks over at HDTV Test... just ran through their testing on the new 700 model, found it to be just as good as the 900, but at a better price point. But what I found interesting about this particular article was that they had some interesting details about testing of these players in particular. And I won't say they pick on Samsung a little bit, but they use it since it is one of the most popular 4K ultra high def players out there. It is highlighted in this article for a couple of specific characteristics. One, and I'll just quote the article here, Samsung's UBDK 8500 deck is using the wrong chroma upsampling method for BT2020 420 content found on 4K Blu-ray discs, resulting in marginally softer picture. A marginally softer picture. And then further down that article, I'll quote again, in BT709 420 content, chroma is co-sided with Luma in the horizontal direction and interstitially in the vertical direction. With 2020, however, chroma has been specced to be co-sided vertically too. Now, and then they go on to state, manufacturers don't realize this will be applying BT709 math for the BT2020 material, such as that with the ultra high def Blu-ray, causing chroma to be shifted vertically by 0.5 pixel. Huh, that sounds problematic. And it's not just Samsung. Now, Oppo apparently is holding back the release of their UDP-203 Universal 4K UHD Blu-ray player while waiting for a fix for this very issue. And apparently the Samsung also suffers from undefeatable noise reduction in the red and blue chroma channels, whereas the Xbox One S is currently using an incorrect RGB decoding, leading to posterization and bright highlights. All of this is just saying, oh, the pain of being on the cutting edge of home theater, and all players, especially these 4K UHD players, are not created equal. Now, I want to know specifically what test material they were using to achieve these results, because currently I'm not aware of any consumer ultra-high-def test material that would allow you to do this. So, and I doubt they're taking something that was authored in 709, or when I said 709, that's specifically referring to the HD color format, or the HD format of video, like 1080p, 720p. Whereas with BT2020, that incorporates the larger color palette, HDR video, and other things like that as well. But it seems that the Panasonic wizards, and Panasonic's always done pretty decent Blu-ray players overall, disc players in general. Mm-hmm. Seems like if you really want the absolute best quality out of a Blu-ray player, it's got to be a Panasonic for the time being, until they get these other players tweaked slightly. They did state, though, within this article, that these errors I am describing in the decoding of the color information, it would be very hard to actually see this on very detailed screens. But I find that, you know, the larger you blow these images up, especially you're going to get into projection and things like that, mm-hmm. that makes it easier to perceive any kind of error. And it's digital information. This is basic math. Not basic math, but it is known, like known quantities.
Is known
there is a way to do this properly. Right. And I can't wait till we get some effective discs just to make this easier. So you can drop a disc in your player, hit a button, look at the pattern and go, okay, hey, mine's not doing that. It's doing the proper decoding and pulling as much detail out of that video signal as possible.
Can the proper maths for BT2020 material be fixed in something like the Samsung UBD K8500?
As long as it's not like baked into the chipset that they're using. Say it's like a Broadcom chipset in there. If that was designed and it's not an upgradable part, there's no firmware to it, then no. But I would hope there's a software workaround for anybody who has an affected player. But again, this is probably not something you're going to be able just to go, oh, if you even side by side, it would probably with identical TVs, identical content and everything else, this would be difficult to do. It's more one of those things where when you're throwing the most challenging, specific video tested stuff and you should get the correct answer every time, it should just do it. And it's not. It's just a little annoying.
Just a little.
And it makes me very pleased that Oppo is one of the player companies out there that everyone considers to be one of the very best. Right. And they're holding back on their release of their next product for that very reason. So that tells you, too, when it ships, it should be one to keep an eye on.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Looking forward to it.
If you don't follow at Robert Heron on Twitter, you should. At least if you're on the Twitters, because you can get things like this. Folks at LG US announced 2,000 lumen Pro Beam smart projector laser engine, 1080p, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth app, slim design. It is stylish.
I like it.
Long and skinny and tall, and looks like it will eliminate a lot of the difficulties in terms of sort of depth of hanging it from ceiling. I think it's
about 4 pounds too. I want to say so.
It's narrow. I mean, it's maybe a couple inches wider than the lens.
If you remember the 1500, their LED. Projector they have, LED RGB light engine.
Right.
Effectively, very similar to that in terms of functionality with the smart features built in, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth. This, on the other hand, swaps out LED illumination for laser illumination, and it bumps up the lumens to 2,000, which is 30% more than that LED projector was claiming. So this is going to be one of the brightest projectors LG has in their consumer lineup, and I am super looking forward to seeing this in action.
When I see laser, I think like lasers. Tens of thousands of dollars.
I know. That's the grand question.
We don't know. We won't know until CES what the price is going to be.
So this is probably single chip DLP. It's 1080p and laser. So it's not dealing with 4K. So it's going to keep the price down there. I would say, if I were guessing, I think it's going to list at 4,000 and then quickly march on down to 3,200 into that range.
Makes sense.
I think so. And if this could become the
sub... It'd be nice. I don't know if it makes sense, but it would be nice.
Well, the nice thing about laser illumination is, one, you have the insanely fast startup and shutdown times. There's almost no warm-up period. It just goes. Right. And likewise, when you turn it off, it just boop. You don't have to worry about lamps popping due to being thermally challenged or anything like that. And longevity. I've never seen a laser system actually fail yet. I'm sure some have somewhere. But they're claiming usually typically around 20,000 hours. So there's another expense you don't have to deal with. So my question is, the thing I really loved about LG's previous projectors is that they incorporated an ATSC tuner that I could use to connect a small antenna and receive my local broadcasts built right into the projector, which was awesome. And They have not responded yet when I asked them if this one will also have an ATSC tuner. They gave me an emoticon smiley face. And I'm like, I don't know what to make of that. Emoticons. I got your emoticon. But anyway, yeah.
Emoticon.
Yeah. And at 4 pounds, if it's anything like the previous LG projectors I've looked at that I've just mentioned, the 1500 and and their others, they include a tripod mount. They're light enough to where you can literally stick it on a tripod. So it makes your mounting options very easy. I mean, it's just like you can throw it on a tripod, you could ceiling mount it, you can do whatever.
We'll take
so
easy.
I can't wait. And I really do hope it has the ATSC tuner, because that's going to be my backyard projector. That's the one I'm dragging out into the as the seasons of sports.
Oh man.
Grow longer and longer.
Oh,
that'll make for some fun outdoor viewing. But 2,000 lumens, 1080p, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, apps, slim
under the
design.
Stars, which you won't be able to see because your vision will be blown out from the 2,000 lumens on the glorious screen.
Can't wait.
Barbecue. HDMI 2.1 at CES 2017. The official announcement.
Yeah.
About 2 weeks at CES 2017. HDMI 2.1 is definitely, we understand, adding HDR metadata dynamic, which essentially means the studio mastering team can tweak, change, modify, make the HDR grade suit the scene it's in, or change it essentially from a scene-to-scene basis. Currently, you know, with the 4K Blu-ray, you get one setting for the whole movie, or for that matter, all the 4K streaming right now.
Except for Dolby Vision.
Yeah. Well, I should point out, I shouldn't say Blu-ray. I shouldn't say 4K Blu-ray, because HDR10, which is the 4K Blu-ray spec for HDR, does not support dynamic metadata, but Dolby Vision does. So I should correct myself, take Blu-ray out of the last sentence, and say HDR metadata dynamic will support the ability to change HDR grade on a scene-to-scene basis.
That will be one of the updates that I am going to assume that we're going to see HDR 10 players that have been updated with the new metadata support. And if you're going to be dealing with that, then you have to have, well, here's the grand question though. With HDMI 2.1, will TVs that currently support 2.0A for HDR input, will those be upgradable to 2.1?
I certainly hope so.
So that they can, you know, if they manage to then release a firmware update for the Blu-ray player to give it support for dynamic metadata that currently exist. And that's even the unknown. We could be on the verge of a whole new hardware buying thing here, where basically, yeah, those first generation of players won't cut it. You have to do this. And if they pull that, I'm going to have words. I'm going to have words at CES.
They will not be polite.
So the other thing it may add as well, and I'm assuming, will be hybrid log gamma support for broadcast content in high dynamic range. And we should be seeing more examples of that through satellite delivery. And they showed it over ATSC last year, over broadcast, from a local Las Vegas station actually doing it live, which was kind of cool. So we'll see more of that for sure. But it's this transition from these HDMI specs as we go forward. It's like, is it just simply brand new chipsets every time, and you're starting from scratch to make any kind of jump whatsoever?
That would certainly suit the CEA and a vast number of consumer electronics manufacturers.
And every time I look at stuff like this, too, I'm like, you know, why not DisplayPort? It's such a nice connector. It's got locking mechanism. It only goes in one way. It looks really... Anyway, I'm babbling.
You're just a little frustrated with HDMI.
Occasionally. It gets me.
That's why I'm sticking back with 1080p for as long as possible, because quite frankly, I'm not going to sell my truck to buy a 4K projector anytime soon.
I want one, but yeah, I'm holding off.
You added into the rundown Sling Air TV Player CNET preview with some sleuthing by Dave Zatz.
Yeah, over at zatznotfunny.com. CNET posted a preview article, Sling's Air TV product. Effectively what it is, it's going to be adding all local live TV support using a built-in antenna for over-the-air goodness. The DVR capabilities are still an unknown, but there is always the cloud if it doesn't have enough internal storage.
We'll do it in the cloud!
And according to the graphics shown on the web page, they're showing Netflix and Google support with voice commands. So, cool. If you are a fan, or you've been wondering if the Sling TV products will ever get over-the-air support, well, the Air TV player looks like it should be on your short list. So, There you have it.
I'm assuming there'll be something there at the sling booth, or at the dish booth anyway, at CES. We'll take a look at that.
Oh, my goodness. You updated your GPU recently. I'm holding out for either a 1050 Ti or a 1060. What'd you go with?
1060, baby. 1060. It was in my budget, to be perfectly honest. I was like, I just needed something that was, I was hoping to effectively double the performance of the card I had in there currently. And it gave me a chance to go back through my workstation and look at the graphic card history. My CPU, laugh at me all you want, this sucker is, I think, 9 years old now.
Yeah.
2006? No.
920?
Maybe it was 2009 I built. So maybe it's like 7 years old. Yeah. Right. The i7-920.
It's a good processor.
I'm gaming at 19:12, so I'm not doing 4K gaming or anything like that. So I don't really need crazy graphics horsepower yet. And this workstation I've had started off with the, back in the day, ATI HD 5870. And then that card blew up on me, so I ended up swapping out for the GTX 570 back in the day. And then I guarantee you a game came along that required more horsepower to get the graphical prettiness out of it. So then I ended up upgrading to a GTX 680, and now finally the GTX 1060 with 6 gigabytes of data. And my basic benchmarking shows it to be literally about twice as fast, at about half the price I had paid for this crazy 680 I bought back in the day. It's a triple slot card, the 680 I bought. It's got the most insane air cooler on it. It's ridiculous. I will say, though, I bought an Asus graphics card, and the Tweak app they have is pretty cool. Gives you a nice feedback of various performance characteristics. It made it really easy to see, like, GPU performance while I'm sitting in the middle of a game. So when I make a tweak to the graphics settings, if it slams it to 100%, I've probably taken it too far. I need to back it down a little bit. And it just made it really easy to quickly, you know, experiment with the graphical goodies within the latest AAA titles and just get it right to where you still have that fluid frame rate, yet taking it all to 10 or 11 if you can in terms of the graphical goodies. And super pleased. It's a better card all around. I mean, it's less power consumption, just as quiet as the last one. Gives me a bunch of output options. Apparently, it's made for more VR stuff. So that was the other thing, too. HDMI 2.0 in a graphics card. Now, if I'll actually be able to do HDR or other things like that with this card, that'll be some other stuff I'll get into as well. It gives me the option of at least having the hardware around in a PC that can support some of that stuff, if need be. So I got it basically just for the gaming performance. Oh, and mentioning DisplayPort again, I will say, first time I've actually used what am I using? I'm using DisplayPort to DVI connectors for these two monitors I have. And there's just something very nice about DisplayPort connectors. I just... Simple.
You're a little obsessed with DisplayPort
connectors.
After
playing around with, like, looking at something like USB, where it's, you get the 50-50 shot of not putting it in the slot right, or it can just be pulled out relatively easily, and then HDMI that also has no locking mechanism, and then you have and DisplayPort's bandwidth. It could already do everything that HDMI 2.0 is doing. Could have did it last year or year. Anyway, I'm really happy with the workstation upgrade, and I think I spent about $250 on the Asus 1060 6 gigabyte version on sale, and I highly recommend it if you're looking for a card. I mean, I don't compared to that 680, it is literally a 2x jump in performance, and it's especially when you get into anything DirectX 12 related. It's just clearly I had missed the boat on that a little bit, but
clearly.
And then also on the shopping list, I had mentioned last week when we were talking about TVs, or we were looking for an AVR for someone that had a lot of HDMI ports that supported HDMI 2.0A. Right. And I just casually mentioned, like, oh, yeah, just throw a switch on that. No problem. And then I got to listen to that episode again. And I'm like, well, how many 4K switches are there that support HDR and all the bandwidth and all the things? Not many.
Yeah.
But I actually did find one from Sewell Direct. Sewell. S-E-W-E-L-L, and I picked up one called the Switch Deck, 5-1, 5x1, one input, five outputs, or I should say, take that back, five inputs, one output. I ran the Chromecast Ultra through it with its HDR content. I had the Samsung Ultra High Def Blu-ray player, the K8500, hooked up to it, in addition to standard 1080p devices simultaneously. And I seem to have no issues whatsoever in terms of...
Nice.
It wasn't... If there was one complaint I'd have about it, the switching speed is a little slow. But it's an auto switcher in the sense that it will do port detection when, like, the device at the end of the food chain turns off. It goes to the next one to see if whatever the next active device is automatically. And that makes it pretty easy. But $70, five in, one out to the TV, 4K HDMI switch that seems to do exactly what I needed. And that's... being able to connect those newest devices that support 4K HDR and all the goodness. But pretty sweet, man. I'm just glad that there are products out there now, because prior to this round, you were talking to some of the super high-end companies that deal with integrator-grade products
right.
to get, you know, 4K switching or amplification, and suddenly you get into that realm of products, and they just add a zero or two to the price of everything. So this right off the boat... $70, and I imagine these will get cheaper and cheaper as time goes on. But I'm just happy to say there is a 4K HDMI switch and an amplifier. The one thing missing that I still haven't seen is an affordable matrix switch. So if you're waiting on a 4K matrix switch, you have the multiple display devices and multiple devices to connect to them. You're looking for matrix switching, and for that, I'm not seeing a 4K device yet. And so I'll keep an eye out for that, because there are just enough of you out there. That would be a useful product.
So. It would be. 20th anniversary of Mars Attacks.
That is.
I love that movie.
That popped up on a Twitter feed from the folks over at. One Perfect Shot. Thank you. And I absolutely love when they post those little trivia bits or just scenes and. The collaboration between the director and cinematographer and all that background stuff. But anyway, it's the 20th anniversary of Mars Attacks, and I picked up the Blu-ray. I know I own the DVD, and I was just too lazy to go crawl into my storage room and try to find it. And I might even have a Blu-ray copy of this movie already, but it was less than $10 for the Blu-ray on Amazon, so I just like, I'll forget it. Just order another one. If nothing else, I'll give it away. But that movie is timeless. It is. There are so many great actors in it, and certain characters being, or certain actors playing multiple characters.
They're pretty funny.
That's just a. And any sci-fi movie where you see the entire House of Congress wiped out in like 5 seconds, hey, man.
Projecting much?
Oh. And then watching the alien walk around, going, "We come in peace," while he's just laying waste to everything. It was just. It's great. Pierce Brosnan.
You a certain level of happiness.
There's so much about that movie that is just great. That's a Christmas flick. That and Die Hard. I'm not even sure what time of the year Mars Attacks takes place in. If
still
it's a holiday.
I'm a big fan of Bad Santa, the original one. I have no idea whether I'm going to want to ever see Bad Santa 2, but Bad Santa 1, truly a timeless classic, which may just say more about my wife and I and our predilections for movies and anything else. I was talking about The Zero Effect a couple weeks ago. It is on, and how I'd never expected it to ever, you know, be available in 1080p. It's on HBO right now.
There you go.
I was so excited.
Always nice.
I was watching that last night, just getting all kinds of thrilled. But that...
when I hit the Can I Stream It website, and it actually returns a positive.
One of my favorite Bill Pullman performances... And Ben Stiller's in there in one of his least annoying performances. But 1998, the world's greatest detective, Daryl Zero, aided by his associate Steve Arlo, investigates a complex and mysterious case of blackmail and missing keys. I love it. Roger Ebert liked it too. 3.5 out of 4 stars. So good review of that. Man, that movie came out a long time ago. I was also looking at the crazy... because I was looking at Steven Spielberg's full list on IMDb.
Ugh.
But just clicking on direct, because it's all of his executive producer stuff.
Yeah, it's endless.
It goes on and on.
The guy's had a busy career.
Yeah, it has. But Thank goodness. I don't know how I feel about, you know, Real Steel 2. I don't know where that can go. I'm a big fan of Real Steel. But Just looking at the director credits, right? He did some TV stuff, and then there's, Sugarland Express was his first film. Jaws, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 1941, which I still love. But, you know, I first saw that when I was like...
Oh, Belushi?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that. That was... I don't really remember what the hell it was about. But.
There's not a. It's not heavy on the plot, but basically it's paranoia and mayhem post Pearl Harbor in Northern California. Sugarland Express is crazy because it's a really amazing class. Goldie Hawn, Ben Johnson, Michael Sachs. It's a really interesting kind of chase films. 1941, you'll either love it or hate it, but Raiders of the Lost Ark, I mean, think about this, right? This is, it starts with Sugarland Express as his first movie at 74, 75 is Jaws, 77 is Close Encounters of the Third Kind, 79 is 1941, which was not well received, 1981 is Raiders of the Lost Ark, 82 is E.T. the Extraterrestrial, he did segment two of Twilight Zone, the movie in 83, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, probably my least favorite movie he did, 1984. The Color Purple in 85, Empire of the Sun, which is extraordinary, in 87. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, probably the last movie I saw in a theater with my mom, which is also fantastic. Always, Hook, which was not a box office success, in 91. 2 years later, he comes back and beats the snot out of the universe with 1993 is Jurassic Park and Schindler's List.
Oh.
97, The Lost World, Jurassic Park. 97 is also Amistad. 98, Saving Private Ryan, which is an extraordinary film, which you should never watch for the first time at 3 in the morning in a hotel during the middle of E3 in Los Angeles.
Oh, no.
Should I pee myself?
Yes, you should. That was Tristan, my 4-year-old, who remembered to go to the potty before peeing himself. Finishes off Stanley Kubrick's AI in 2001. Minority Report, which is still fantastic, 2002. We also did Catch Me If You Can, which is a fun movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. This crazy list. Crazy list. British Spies, Lincoln,
it's just War Horse,
The Adventures of Tintin. This is just what he's done as a director.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too. You get into the rest of his works, just supporting or working on other projects. And it's it doesn't end.
Aaron, a.k.a., it's time for some viewer questions. Aaron, a.k.a., at M750, tweets, at Patrick Norton, is there a show I should reference for reasonably priced HDMI cables? We just talked about him on Tech Thing 102, but the too long didn't read answer is Amazon Basics high-speed HDMI cable.
Yep. Can't go wrong.
Yeah. Two for $12. You know, they do them in 1-packs, 2-packs, and 3-packs.
Buy a bunch.
Yeah. This is what I'm redoing everything.
Swap a cable out if there's any question that it might be defective.
If you have a stack of stuff, like the 3-foot HDMI cables are great. You know, that's as short as they do them. I've seen HDMI cables as short as a foot and a half, which basically if you don't want to sort of get your Velcro ties out and start wrapping stuff up.
I used a 12 or 18-inch ultra-thin or ultra-slim HDMI cable for connecting an Intel Nook to a monitor just to make it nice.
And the 10-foot cables are back in stock. But, yeah, two 10-foot cables for $12, two 6-foot cables for $11.98.
Yeah.
Three packs are available.
I buy a regular supply of those 6-foot cables.
So, yeah, between the two of us, we probably have a half dozen, a dozen.
It's just like if there's ever an issue, if I'm at a client's house or my own gear or whatever, if there's, just get rid of that damn cable and put a good one in there. Make sure it's a known working cable.
I have to think I have to replace the HDMI. I'm going to have to replace the HDMI cable for the new projector running up between the wall studs into the ceiling, under the 14 inches of insulation, and back down through the ceiling to the projector. That's going to suck.
Punch up through the ceiling.
Well, it's already punched up through the ceiling.
Oh, okay.
But I'm gonna if I get lucky,
fish
I can
wire
pull
goes up
the,
there.
I think I'm gonna tape the old cable to the new
depending
cable
on how big the hole
and
is.
Pull it up into the attic. Well, I'm gonna do it now, so I don't try to do it in the summer when it's 140 degrees up there.
I've
But I'm not looking forward to replacing that cable. So,
The only time I spend more on
$12 for two.
Yeah, the only time I spend more on cables is more than say $1 a foot on those Amazon cables is when I want the ultra slim stuff, like what Monoprice and other companies make. And for those, they cost about $2 a foot, but it's excellent. And all of these cables support everything: 3D, 4K, you name it.
At least until 2.1.
I will say though, if you're looking at active HDMI cables specifically, the ones that are directional, and sometimes those ultra slim cables are active cables, you want to make sure that in the branding of it, somewhere specifically, it says 18 gigabit per second. Because anything listing 10 gigabit at this point is not going to work with the latest and greatest 4K HDR stuff. So that's pretty much the only thing you got to look out for. any regular cable is going to be fine for anything. But it's just for those active cables. You just got to make sure you're getting one that's rated actually at moving up to 18 gigabits so it can do the full beautiful, colorful HDR experience.
One last thing before we go. At Kiddo1986 tweeted, at Robert Heron, at Patrick Norton, at AVXL. Quick, need gift idea. Best regular Blu-ray to show off new home theater setup. Setting up tomorrow for Uncle. Oh, my goodness.
I watched The Revenant last night. I wouldn't say I actually watched it, though. I was more or less just...
suffered through it?
No, it was like just... there are scenes in there that are fantastic looking. I mean, just beautifully done. Mm-hmm. But that whole bear thing where he's playing with that bear for like 30 minutes, man, just chewing on each other.
No spoilers.
That's brutal.
We don't do spoilers on this show.
I couldn't even tell you what the story's about. All I can tell you is that visually, it is a fantastic looking flick. And that's high up on my list. Also, two reference titles I keep around are, let me see, Baraka and Samsara, both done by, I want to see, McGivory Freeman Films.
Uh-huh.
Basically, these were worldwide productions shot on 70mm film, 8K transfers to 4K interstitials to the Blu-ray you finally see.
Whenever I hear 8K transfer, I think The Wizard of Oz restoration,
which
is an amazing Blu-ray.
Finally produced, naturally shot content. Uh-huh. Some of it is definitely not for everybody. I mean, some of it's artistic in a way that you may not find your taste. some of it's also quite graphic, too, in terms of like, wow, it's not all happy stories, but it's visually amazing to look at. And, both those titles, Barak and Samsara. Yeah. Same group. Literally, this was like a couple years between these two projects, but
they're gorgeous.
Yeah. Just phenomenal content at high bit rate, good quality. Then again, it's like there's a lot of great looking movies out there, too.
Well, I mean, one that comes up, Mad Max, Fury Road,
visually
The Martian.
I like that movie a lot.
Tom Hardy.
God, I love Tom Hardy in that movie.
Oh, amazing.
He's awesome.
I like Tom Hardy in anything, actually.
That role in particular. I just like that take on Mad Max.
Well, it's amazing. I mean, I didn't realize how talented an actor Tom Hardy was until I realized, you know, it's funny because he's in Peaky Blinders, which I love, playing Alfie Solomons. But the thing that made me realize what a fantastic actor he was in between... where is it? Inception. Realizing it was the same actor in Inception and then Warrior, where he plays Tommy Conlon in Warrior, which is the really amazing sort of UFC movie. Warrior's a fantastic, fun, you know, kind of fun. Well, fun's probably not the right word for it. A lot of father issues, a lot of suffering, a lot of loss, but good flick. Inception is amazing. One of the movies I put on my list, but yeah,
he's mentioning regular Blu-rays too. So yeah, those Samsara and Baraka are both regular Blu-rays. Mm-hmm. That version of the DiCaprio movie I just talked about, that actually I was watching in 4K. So that's kind of like I'm cheating there.
Yeah, it still looks pretty good.
Fantastic.
Mad Max Fury Road, The Martian, Wizard of Oz. If you've never seen the Blu-ray restoration of Wizard of Oz and you're a Wizard of Oz fan, get it. It's amazing. John Wick's one of my favorites. The Avengers Age of Ultron, although some people disagree because they felt the audio soundtrack wasn't up for that. Inception, I love that movie. Big Hero 6, BBC Planet Earth, Avatar, Inside Out, Skyfall, Gravity, Game of Thrones, Iron Man 3, Fast and Furious 7, although, you know, Tokyo Drift is still my favorite. Lego Movie, Edge of Tomorrow, Guardians of the Galaxy, and I said I'd stop now.
I would throw out there, too, the that Star Trek 9, the one with Chris Pine. That movie has just been gone over so many times, and they use it specifically in demoing some of these HDR TVs and wide color gamut TVs. Mm-hmm. Granted, the Blu-ray is not providing that, but that is definitely one of those flicks where many people have looked at it in terms of the coloring, the detail, preservation, and it should be a good title as well. But it's also, too, if you're looking to impress a specific person with,
right.
Sometimes it's the content itself. So if you know a favorite movie of theirs, pick it up in a high-quality version, mm-hmm. specifically Blu-ray if you can, and roll with that, especially any of the, man, those black and white classics from Hitchcock or some of those have been in the re-releases look so freaking good, man. Mm-hmm. It's just
Casablanca is always fun to watch.
The cinematography style and just the ease on your eyes and the senses of just the way it's presented and the way it looks. I just it's good to go back and look at that stuff to realize sometimes, you know, the old ways were pretty good.
One last thought before we go. Really, this is the last one. At Kelly217 tweets, is it wrong for me to wish this were a vodcast? And I'm going to say no. Like it says on patreon.com/AVXL, when we hit $1,000 a month on Patreon, quote, hey, we'll start shooting one of our weekly shows in a Google Hangout that posts on YouTube. You can play it back over and over and over and over.
I like that idea.
So please.
I do.
Break out your credit card, go to patreon.com/AVXL, and help us keep the podcast going. And if you get us up to $1,000, we'll start recording an episode in video. And if you get us up to $2,000, we'll start recording two episodes in video, because video is harder than audio.
Yeah. We do have another Patreon hangout coming up. Patreon hangout.
Yes.
Patreon hangout.
Should we complicate our lives and do it at CES? Or should we do it after CES when we can see again?
It would be after for sure, because we'll have a pile of questions after that show. And it's going to be it'll be good to sit and reflect with our fans.
We'll record an episode of AVXL at CES, because I'm driving the truck down, so I'll bring the podcasting gear. But I was laughing because I was looking at Media Day 1. Opens up with, you know, Fiat Chrysler, which I don't even know how to deal with that. But then Honor, Qualcomm, CES Unveiled, which is the big gathering. I've got LG at 8 a.m. on Media Day 2. Panasonic, TCL, Hisense, Samsung, the UHD Alliance, Intel, ZTE, Sony, NVIDIA. Then another big gathering of 200 vendors at Digital Experience. Then the actual show floor opens on Thursday.
It's going to be good.
Yeah. I'm kind of excited.
I'm hitting the ground running. Be there till Saturday.
Running and running. So much going on.
Got the meetup on
Friday night.
Friday night. At Atomic Liquor.
7 till who knows how late downtown.
Let's get obliterated.
I'm the designated driver.
I'm going home the next day.
I have to crawl onto that plane hating your life. I want you to be so hungover you're afraid to fly, and you ask if you can sleep in and drive home with me.
The metal tube that soars through the air is my safe place. I don't care how bad I feel. Just put me on the flight. I'll be fine by the time I get off the plane.
Airport. Somehow I'll get you to the airport.
Uber, baby. I'm Ubering my butt everywhere.
With that, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on AVXL. If this is your first episode of AVXL and you want to hear more, go to AVXL.com or search for AVXL on your favorite podcatcher. You can find more of Mr. Robert Heron at Heron Fidelity. You can find me at Tech Thing with my other co-host, Shannon Morris, getting our tech geek thing on. And please, if you get a moment, share this with your friends or anybody who is into the whole home theater entertainment thing you think might like it, because the more of you there are, the more likely we are to be able to keep this going. Send us your questions to @AVXL, or better yet, ask@AVXL, because we're on the email all the time, because we're old school like that, except when we're new school. So yeah, we need Snapchat.
We're
gonna start Snapchatting.
I'm on Instagram somewhere. I don't know what the hell I'm doing there, but
just post photos. Post your photos and get out of the way, you perv.
I'm on the Twitters.
With that, it's close to Christmas. We're giddy. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, and I'm Robert Heron.
We'll see you next week on AVXL.